Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. Full moon of July, full moon of Asala, Asala Puja. Welcome to Aya and the community from Satisaraniya. And welcome to Venerable Suvijano, just came. It's very nice to see a larger Sangha for us who are in these rather remote areas. And was Suvijano comes from a monastery of 100 monks, maybe. And Venerable Chunda comes from a monastery of 15 monks. And Atulo had, how many, 50 at Ajahn Dunn's? Something like that, and so on. And Venerable Kemiko from Abhayagiri. So for them, this is a small monastery. For me, it's a bigger monastery. And these are the way perceptions work. Big, small, and the way we categorize and organize our mind around the worldly things. Asala Puja is a time where we often reflect on the teachings of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which we chanted, teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And it's sometimes it's called Dhamma Day, Dharma Day. And this teaching of the Four Noble Truths is really our life as monastics and lay people is a really it's an exploration of this sutta throughout our lives. It's not just an academic thing which you memorize or put away somehow. It's something which is very, very alive. It needs to be made alive constantly through reflection, through remembering the basic structures of the Four Noble Truths, and then exploring your own consciousness, your own experience of life through these Four Noble Truths, because it's through this, through the contemplation of suffering that we realize the end of suffering. So it's very important teaching as a contemplative vehicle, as something which constantly orients you towards what the Buddha was asking us to do, constantly guides us towards what's really, really, really important in our lives. We live by the, as monastics, we live by the Dhamma Vinaya. As lay people, you live by the Dhamma and your own precept structures and your own responsibilities in the ordinary world. A life of Vinaya is a life of personal responsibility where we relate to our social situation through the personal responsibility of living by precepts, living by the conventions of the Vinaya that we have undertaken. And this is a personal responsibility. This is something that we pick up personally, and then we adhere to that through a sense of honor, through a sense of faith in the Buddha, through a sense of interest in the Vinaya. How does the Vinaya work and how can we use that? And the Dhamma is relating to the world in a different way. It's relating to the world through the perception of change. So, for instance, I have, all of us have responsibilities. Say both I and I, we are senior people in our communities, so we have we take initiative. I take initiatives. I contact people to try to create good situations for requisites and for the practice. This involves financial commitments, involves all manner of worldly things, and so on. That is the level of the Vinaya. I try to be personally responsible for the decisions I make. I try to be responsible for the kind of direction of the whole thing. And that's the kind of vinaya of being a senior person. But of course, that also could create certain things in my own mind. So I tend to worry, and so something that constantly comes up is worry about resources. Are we too isolated? Do we have enough money to run this, and so on and so forth? And that I have to relate to through the perception of change. On some level, I have to take personal responsibility. So I have to think, well, is this a reasonable thing to do? But then as the mind reacts to the different things that come up, the way the projects go, or the way people relate to me, or the different complexities that one deals with as a senior person, creates results in the mind. And then the Dhamma practice is to look at that, of course, through the khandhas rather than through a personal problem. And then to relate to the khandhas, we need to relate to them through the perception of change. And that's what really liberates us. And if we only have, if we have worldly conventions without the Dhamma, then there is no real liberation. If we only have some sense of the Dhamma, but we don't take personal responsibility for our decisions and the things that we do in the world, it becomes very easily very selfish and chaotic or anarchic. So these two, the way to relate to the world, one is through personal responsibility and one is to relate through the perception of change. It's the way I kind of look at Vinaya and Dhamma. Both are important. Both are very important. To relate to our, say, precept structures and our rules through personal responsibility means that we study it, we take it on board, and we make determinations to live by certain values which inform our speech, which inform our action, which inform our livelihood. So when I take personal responsibility for my speech, if I find I want to say things which are according to Vinaya, but my mind is coming from some kind of a place of aversion or whatever, then that speech needs to be moderated, doesn't it? Right speech. It's moderating our speech to the sense of what's appropriate. But then the inner world, the Dhamma world, I observe that aversion, or I observe that, whatever it might be, through the perception of change. So the Vinaya is like a dance. It's a kind of way we learn how to live with each other. Not necessarily like each other. Now that's impossible all the time. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But there is a sense of honoring each other in this work that we're doing, a sense of all of us have this yearning for liberation, yearning for the end of suffering. And that's what we're trying to honor in each other, not just our judgments of each other. This takes a very kind of noble attitude. It takes a kind of rising up out of the quagmire of judgmental mind states and all the pettiness of human interaction that we can have, and rising above that to see that even though you and I might not be getting along, sometimes we do and sometimes we don't, what's really important is that you are aspiring to nibbana, to liberation, as am I. That's sometimes hard to keep in mind. Because I was saying after the Patimokkha, the community life, where our kilesa manifest is around each other, because that's the only place it could manifest towards the deer fly, that's for sure, and the mosquitoes and so on. So it can manifest around nature, but in terms of personal relationships, quite often where our fears and desires and judgments and angers and all of that, the negative part, can manifest towards each other, because it's the only place it can manifest. But so also the others, the sense of generosity, the sense of nobility, the sense of encouragement that can also arise within us. And somehow being responsible in that personal realm is important. So we have very, very strong recommendations about right speech, don't we? Really, you know, if you read the Metta Sutta or read the encouragement for right speech, it's very, very high-minded, and takes a lot of training actually to speak rightly. But then our hearts don't necessarily, you know, we're not necessarily in love with each other or like each other, and so our hearts can experience all manner of negativity, and that's fine. That's perfectly fine, because it's just in the nature of the heart to do that sometimes. So that part we can't take personally. So on one hand we take things personally, on the other hand we don't take them personally. This is a kind of a paradox. On the one hand, if I act in the Sangha in ways which are inappropriate to Vinaya, then all the bhikkhus, their duty is to reprimand me and to point out my errors. It's part of our duty to each other to point that out. And so I have to take personal responsibility for that. It's my responsibility. And that's Vinaya. That's the convention. But then inwardly, the movement of love and hate, the movement of disappointment and interest and boredom and all that kind of movement, I need to relate to that through the perception of change. How do I relate to things through the perception of change? Well, you begin with simple things, don't you? You start with the sound of the fan, and you listen. Now, how do you relate to the sound of the fan through the perception of change? Well, first of all, you have to be here. If we're thinking about something else, you can't really hear the fan. So there's a deep necessity to be present. That's obvious. And that's not so easy. Our minds can be very distracted into planning and thinking and worrying and so on. So this constant reminder, be here now, awaken to what's going on now. And then if you really awaken to sound, then there in the sound, there's just the sound. And in that listening to change, what do you have to do to actually hear the changing nature of that fan? You have to let go of wanting it to be anything than other than it is. If I want the fan to be other than it is, I'm not listening. And in that listening, I can also notice the wanting then. So the perception of change is an awakening in a way which is not judgmental, where it notices judgment. It's not demanding anything. It's standing as witness to change. And this is something we need to train in. It doesn't come automatically, because it seems so very ordinary just to listen to change. But try to sustain that for 10 minutes. Just try to sustain that listening quality to change for 10 minutes. You find it's not so easy, because the mind will get bored with it, want something else, think about something else, pain will come up in the body and so on. So the perception of change then is the way of insight meditation, the way of attending to life in a way of non-attachment, non-grasping. And the particular thing that the Buddha asks us to pay attention to through the perception of change is discomfort. All the modes of discomfort that we experience, or dukkha, in all the different ways that we have dukkha. And this is a big step in human consciousness, because the sort of obvious way that we are conditioned to attend to dukkha is through the reaction of getting rid of it. Get rid of the discomfort and move towards the comfort. And so that works to a certain extent. That creates a certain amount of comfort. But as we all know, it doesn't really liberate the heart. It simply puts us in, at times, into states of comfort, which is a kind of situational comfort, isn't it? It's dependent. It's dependent on being able to do that. And when the conditions, causing conditions change, and then we're just uncomfortable again, then we seek comfort. And so this is samsara, the seeking of comfort and the avoidance of discomfort. Association with the unloved is suffering. Association, not getting what you want, is suffering. Getting what you don't want is suffering. And so the Buddha is asking us, well, awaken to that association with the dislike, this suffering, awaken to that discomfort, being with something that you do not like or do not want, some kind of discomfort emotionally, physically, awaken to that through the perception of change. And that's the more difficult. That's more difficult. Almost counterintuitive, isn't it? We experience it in our sittings. You know, when you're sitting and if your body is hurting after 40 minutes or something like that, and the sitting is going on, then there is discomfort. And what do we do with that? What do we do with that discomfort? Do we make it fully conscious, discomfort, through the perception of change? In the beginning, no, we don't do that. When we begin to meditate, as soon as we feel discomfort, we change our posture. But after a while, we realize it doesn't really work. It doesn't make the mind calm. And we somehow, for some reason, through suggestion, through experimentation, we begin to intuit that being aware of change, being aware of discomfort through the perception of change, is also a possibility. We don't have to necessarily move away from it. And so I think we all discover that discomfort comes up and we think about it, we think about the sitting going to end, but we stop, we awaken. What is it? What is discomfort? What is physical discomfort? Especially if it's, you know, if it's going to hurt you, then you move, obviously. But just the normal discomfort of a human body is a great lesson. There's a lot to be learned in that. The Four Noble Truths are right there. So we feel discomfort in the body, and at some point we awaken to what is discomfort. We allow that to come fully into consciousness, just like listening to the sound of the fan. But now, what we see is there's also desire. We see there's the desire to not have the discomfort. We begin to understand that the cause of suffering is attachment to desire, not just through an academic agreement with the Buddha's teaching, but rather through an existential experience. And this is insight. We see it right there. So the body feels discomfort. You make conscious the discomfort. You make it fully conscious. What do we have to do? I have to be present to it. And notice how difficult that is. The mind thinks about something else, distracts, looks at the clock, shifts the posture. That's all moving away from it. It's not a willful act. It's not like willfully, I'm not going to move. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to move. That's not really being mindful. It's just being willful without it necessarily having any wisdom. But being fully conscious through the perception of change, that kind of training brings insight. This is how insight arises. And through that little exercise, we see that we keep lifting the mind into like a full awake appreciation of discomfort. We keep coming to that. The mind, our attention moves away, distracts, thinks. We keep coming to that. And at some point, we can hold that. We can hold that perception of change. We can be with discomfort through the perception of change for longer periods of time, longer periods of time. And lo and behold, we find that, oh, actually, this is okay. This is peaceful. It is peaceful. And then we begin to realize the third noble truth, the cessation of desire, the cessation of suffering, because we've been willing to bear with unfulfilled desire. We've been willing to be patient. And patience is really very key to this, isn't it? Because the mind, which would like comfort in all its various ways, and is always moving toward in that vein, is a very restless mind. It doesn't know how to settle with the way things are. We take neutral things. You begin with a fan. And you just learn how to sustain attention on perception of change. Just take neutral things, like the feeling of your hands, the temperature in your body, just little things like that, and cultivate the perception of change. Now, cultivating that perception of change is not trying to get anything. You're not trying to. When I first came upon these teachings, I thought, well, I had to get some kind of experience of the perception of change, which would then sort of like blow me away totally into some kind of nibbonic realm. But I realized that was still desire. So I was looking at the changing nature of things, but I still had the desire to get some kind of other experiences. So I really wasn't aware of desire. But awakening to the way things are through the perception of change is the way we relate constantly. And it's not, there's no end game in it. That is the end game. That is the practice. That is bhavana. That's what we do. Now, what things are very, very difficult the things that we get, say, very attached to and lost into are the things that we find difficult to be awake through the perception of change. All kinds of, like, say, self-disparagements we might have, self-judgments that we might have. These quite often are so seemingly real, seemingly truthful, that we don't see the perception of self-hatred as simply a perception that's arisen, stays for a while and ceases. We think it is some kind of a reality. I really am like that. But the perception of change isn't a judgment about thoughts or perceptions or ideas or bodily feelings. It simply is noticing the khandhas as things which arise and cease, arise and cease. So the formulation is different. The formulation around the life, the experience of being human is now through the five khandhas. The formulation of the Vinaya is through personal responsibility. And there is Viradhamma, and he has a certain status in the Sangha, and he has certain responsibilities, and he has a bowl, and his bowl is there, and he has kutis over there. So we use the sense of I there, the sense of a person, otherwise we couldn't really do this. Not as a kind of ultimate truth, but really just as a convention. And within that convention, there's personal responsibility. But if I wake up and I'm feeling quite negative in some way, am I responsible for that? I have to take responsibility for the mood in terms of vinaya. I can't just dump it on anyone. But is it my fault I feel negative? Am I a bad person for feeling negative? No, it's just what has arisen. It's just a condition which has arisen according to exhaustion or boredom or whatever. It's just arisen in consciousness. And when it is known through the perception of change, it is not a problem. It is not suffering. A negative mind state is not suffering. It is simply emotional discomfort. When it becomes suffering, it is through the attachment, the identity with it. When we do not perceive it through change, but we presume it as a personal problem, and we project it outwards onto someone else, so we project it into our own hearts and blame ourselves, da-da-da-da-da, etc., etc., self-view. So self-view, self-identity, all these things are conventions we use for the vinaya, but through the khandha formulations, these are simply forces in nature. Whether it's beautiful, harmonious, or whether it's ugly and disharmonious, it is what it is. It's neither here nor there. So the contemplation of discomfort takes us to the real heart of the problem. The contemplation of unfulfilled desire, the awakening to getting what you don't want, or not being able to get what you want. Really awaken to that feeling of not being able to get what you want. What is that feeling like? Through the perception of change, what does that do? Well, you as you patiently witness not getting what you want, or getting what you don't want, you have to be very awake, you have to be very present. It doesn't happen on its own. Your desire mind doesn't want to be with it. Your desire mind projects outwards, well, if that person were different, I could get what I want. Or if I was different, I wouldn't be like this. That's all projection. But actually, just awakening to not getting what you want. And this is a feeling of not getting what I want. And just bear with that, witness that as change. And where does that take you? It takes you to not want, the end of wanting. The end of wanting, the cessation of suffering. And this is peaceful. This is not circumstantial. Because why? You've gone against the circumstance. You've challenged it now in a very skillful way, not through blindly repressing whatever. This takes honesty, takes courage, takes determination, takes persistence. Many factors come into play here. But it's this capacity to know the stream of consciousness, to know body is body through the perception of change, vedana is vedana through the perception of change, sanya is sanya through the perception of change, the constructs, the mental constructs, the endless stories through the perception of change, all our sense experience through the perception of change. That's what we apply. And it is a training. It's not just like a one-off. Oh, that's changing, and you go to the next topic. No, the mind needs to somehow abide as that, or attention needs to abide as that. It is a training. Doubt comes up. Am I doing it right? Through the perception of change. This is not so very complicated. But quite often we don't have faith in that. Where we tend to have faith, we have faith more in the desire to become something and the desire to get rid of something. If we don't see that desire, the whole sense of becoming, bhava tanha, the sense of trying to annihilate, get rid of, vibhava tanha, if we're not fully conscious of that, how can there be a good result? Because we are driven by the very thing the Buddha says we have to abandon. We have to abandon the cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is attachment to desire. Kama tanna, bhava tanna, vibhava tanna. So the peace of non-desire, it's there. Sometimes we don't seem so gray and so ordinary when you just listen to the fan. And without desire, it doesn't seem like much. Non-desire. But do it for a while and you'll see desire will come up. Discomfort in the body, whatever. But actually sustain that. Sustain it on an object. Sustain it on a neutral object like the breath or whatever. Sustain it for a long time, the perception of change. And then through the sustaining of that, you begin to see how desires arise. You see them in the context of that type of mindfulness. You see in the context of that way of being in the world. And as desires arise, you say, oh, that's the discomfort, unfulfilled desire. And you learn how to sustain attention on that through the perception of change. And as that desire tries to fool you, tries to go into thought, I know you, Mara. And you sustain through patience and endurance the capacity to be with the unloved, to be with something that's uncomfortable, physical pain, emotional loneliness, irritation at one of your fellows, all kinds of things. But they're just khandhas, arising and ceasing, uncertain. Try it out. You can. This teaching isn't something that if you just give some kind of academic acknowledgement that you agree with it, it won't really liberate you. So that's why our life is a life, in the Sangha especially, it's a life of living by the Vinaya and exploring these Four Noble Truths. Constantly exploring it. Because suffering's always coming up, isn't it? Some sense of being offended by someone or not liking the schedule or wanting the... Certainly, I think all of us want the flies to go away. It's what I suffer from. And the weather's not good enough or... something about the food, some people are into food things and the food doesn't fit their view of diet and da-da-da-da-da, it goes on and on and on. So to believe all that, well, we can believe some of it, so we have the Vinaya. And we have ways, like taking care of your body. We have a personal responsibility to take care of the body. And so we need to exercise it and give it kind of appropriate food and do the best you can. But then there's worry too. There's worry about health. There's fear. There's hypochondria. There's all kinds of things around the body, mental states, fearful mental states. These need to be acknowledged through the perception of change. So you do the best you can, but then within that, does the body present modes of desire, of fear, of worry, that are actually can be attended to through mindfulness rather than through medication? This is important. The way we relate with each other, you know, that when we live together in community, we press each other's buttons. And we have buttons. This is just the nature of our karma. Someone does something which you don't like or whatever. How could it be otherwise? How could it be different? We as I was saying after the Patimokkha, all of us are experience the kind of karmic results of various things which we maybe are surprised by. We fall into foul moods. We feel discouraged and disappointed and disillusioned. All these things come up. And somehow we have to bear witness to that as change. It's not easy. But also as community, we need to allow people to be unhappy, to be unfulfilled, to be uninspired, to be bored. Still living within the Vinaya, but not demanding that it, you know, you should be happy today for me. That's impossible. So we try to encourage each other, you know, to, you know, the best we can with kindness and compassion and generosity. But there will be times where the formation called Viradhamma will not be very pretty because of exhaustion or tiredness or a bad mood. And all of us will have that, won't we? But it's contemplative. Someone else is having a hard time. Why shouldn't they have a hard time? How can I help them? Maybe I just leave them alone. Let them go through it rather than cheer them up all the time. Sometimes that can be really annoying when you're going through something very difficult and everyone's trying to cheer you up. You think, you leave me alone, I'm trying to be depressed. It's true. Sometimes you just want to look at something. You want to be serious, don't you? Everyone's being terribly nice. On the other hand, it can be very lovely. You know, you're down and someone says, hey, Viradhamma, how about a cup of tea? It can be very lovely. You don't know. But how do we relate to each other, I think, in a way that allows this kind of purification that we're all going through? I think it's through not holding fixed perceptions of each other. And to look at our own fears when we feel intimidated by someone else's mood. To look at those fears and say, well, that's my business. That's my fear. Now how can I attend to that fear through the perception of change? And the more I attend to my own heart through these ways, the more I'll be able to relate to you, you know, through some kind of way which is strong and clear and appropriate to time and place. So you don't know. You never know what the day will bring, but we somehow try to be very, if we're very clear about our own desires and our own demands on each other, and we just see, well, that's something in my mind, perceive it through the perception of change, and that's the greatest possibility of some kind of authentic communication. Sometimes we attach to ideas of like harmony. I certainly can. I want harmony. I want a harmonious community. But that's my problem. Right? It's my problem. How can we always be harmonious? We can live by the Vinaya. You know, that's something we need to do. But sometimes disharmony is just in the nature of human relationships. And that's okay. But for my desire mind, it prefers harmony. It finds disharmony uncomfortable. So what to do? Well, one is just try to make everything hunky-dory and harmonious and get exhausted and burnt out. I've done that. It's not a good option. The other is just to run away. Haven't done that one yet. But the third one is the Four Noble Truths. Is that the sense of discomfort with something in the community feels this way, through the perception of change, rather than through the perception of self and other, and trying to fix it, and trying to make everything right, and trying to make everyone happy, which is a very losing end game. So then when one feels that, wanting the community to be something, or wanting some other person to be something, as a discomfort, unfulfilled desire, this is the feeling of getting something that I don't want, through the perception of change, then it ceases. The desire runs its course. Then there's the best chance for appropriate communication. Because one's free. One doesn't have an agenda which needs to be fulfilled by others. So community life is like we do, you know, we try to help each other and make this life meaningful and helpful and so on, but also we leave each other alone. You know, we let the person be with their karma in some way. And there's no fixed way you can define that. On the one hand, a very self-centered person could be so self-centered they never even notice their brother's broken leg. You know, he breaks his legs, he says, well, it's his karma, not mine, and go to my kuti. That's an absurd kind of extreme. So we do care for each other. But we're not in each other's pockets all the time. You know, we allow for some privacy. Because the way that Lopa Cha, I think, set up our monasteries, and at least from the way I've learned it also from Lopa Sumedho, is we try to get this balance of solitude and community, where we have our kutis, we have a solitary time, and then we have our communal time. And how can we do both? We have the winter retreat, lots of solitude. How am I in solitude, and how am I in community? Where are my weaknesses in either one? If I attach to solitude, then community is a hassle. If I attach to hassle, if I always need community, I feel restless in solitude. How do I do both? And I think that's the model I've learned, which I try to guide this place in. So these Four Noble Truths are in the context of Vinaya, in the context of the social structures that we all adhere to and our responsibilities within that. And we do have responsibilities, and we do have personal responsibilities. And within that, there's this constant exploration of discomfort and the end of discomfort, of discontent and the end of discomfort. And the way we do that is through the perception of change. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Annamayam Dhammakathaya Sadhukaram Dadamase
Sadhu, Sadhu.